Hey marketers, if you want to get the latest news, trends, and insights in marketing, advertising, and tech, check out the Adweek Podcast Network. Learn from leading voices across media and marketing with original shows like Yeah, That's Probably an Ad, Marketing Vanguard, and Tech Magic with Kathy Hackle. Start listening now by searching Adweek wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there, are you ready to elevate your personal brand or company? Meet Viral Growth, your one-stop shop for video content and audience building. Imagine growing your brand organically on social media without the hassle of editing videos for hours. With Viral Growth, it's a breeze. They handle the brainstorming, scripting, and editing while you simply just hit record. And don't worry about your niche. They cater to everyone, from business and marketing to health and wellness. Are you ready to make waves in the social media realm? Visit viralgrowth.io and use code ADWEEK, that's ADWEEK, all lowercase, and get 10% off your plan.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/generate to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/generate. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
You're listening to Yeah, That's Probably an Ad. This is the Adweek Podcast, where we talk about marketing, media, TV, pop culture, technology, because in the end, everything's an ad. I'm David Greiner. I'm the creative and innovation editor with Adweek. With me back, as always, is Kimiko McCoy, our social editor and co-host of the podcast. Kimiko, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Always happy to be here.
Wonderful. Thanks for making time for us, as always. Also got back Lisa Lacey, a staff writer here at Adweek, who covers the kind of world of retail and technology. Lisa, thanks for joining us again.
Well, thanks for having me.
And also got back. It's been a while. We go through these spurts where we have you on like 4 weeks in a row. So right around when fall seems to be creeping up, it's Jason Lynch, our editor who covers the TV, video, media worlds. Jason, thanks for joining.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
We've got a few big things for you to talk about. And on the news front, on the where you've been for the last, just like 2 weeks?
3 weeks.
Not that you were
three
counting.
Three very long weeks.
At the Television Critics Association summer press tour, which is sounds like just nonstop cavalcade of meetings and updates on what TV networks and other major players are up to. So we'll be talking about kind of the highlights of that. You could distill down those three fun weeks for us into a short podcast discussion. And we'll also be talking about our Project Isaac winners. This is Adweek's big award for innovation in marketing and product innovation. And it's always one of the most fun awards we do each year to talk about. So we'll be going over some of our favorites from this year that are featured in this week's edition of the print magazine. But first, let's talk about the big news. All right, Jason. So CBS and Viacom are merging. It sounds like this wasn't a huge surprise to a lot of people who had been watching this. And also, what's fascinating to me is, I mean, they just split up like 13 years ago, right?
They did. And you know, probably in hindsight, they never should have done that. And I guess they said it sounded like a good idea at the time. This is also something that they've been talking about this on and off for the last 3 years. And there were basically three separate periods where there were very intense conversations about a potential merger. And then the third and final time those talks really picked up was earlier this summer. And we've basically been waiting every week. Is this going to be the week they finally announce it? They had really tried to get this announcement out by last Thursday or about a week ago when each company had their earnings calls on the same day. They couldn't make that deadline. And they finally did a few days later. So, yes, they are going to be recombining. It's something that Sherry Redstone, who is the head of National Amusements, the company that owns both of those companies. Her father is Sumner Redstone. You know, she's been pushing this for a very long time. The biggest kind of the biggest obstacle in this was former CBS CEO Les Moonves, who really did not think this idea made sense for a lot of reasons. Lots of arguments over who would kind of control that new company. And then when he was out a year ago, for his sexual harassment, many sexual harassment allegations. So that big obstacle was kind of removed. So this seemed like a foregone conclusion at that point. And now we're at the point where it's actually going to happen. And at some point, they say by the end of the year, these companies will combine into a single entity called Viacom CBS.
That's a very original name. I like when they really stretch themselves. So remind us, I know we've talked about Viacom recently with, Pluto TV and, yep. and some of the other things they've done, but remind us some of the bigger components that Viacom owns.
So this is definitely a merger on a smaller scale than some of the ones we've talked about in the last year, AT&T, Time Warner, or Disney Fox. This is a much smaller version of that. So what CBS brings to the table is obviously the CBS network, but they also have CBS All Access. They have Showtime. They have the Pop TV cable network. They have a couple other elements. But then Viacom brings both the Paramount Movie Studio and then their slew of cable networks, MTV, Nickelodeon, TV Land, the Paramount Network, among many others, as well as Pluto TV, as we've discussed before, which was that free AVOD service that they bought earlier this year. So, as you look at this, this doesn't necessarily seem like as good a fit as some of the other mergers that we've had. But I feel like one area that this is going to be great for both companies is going to be in the streaming world. CBS already has CBS All Access up and running, and it's been that way for 5 years. And when you have all these other companies trying to get into the streaming service this year, Warner Media and NBC Universal next year and Apple and Disney, they have a five-year head start, and now they're going to be able to take all the Viacom library content and put that in there. Then going the other direction, Viacom has Pluto TV, this free streaming service, which they can then take CBS content and help that. So it feels like this two-pronged approach to the streaming world, where there'll be a subscription option, but then there'll also be a free option, is kind of a great 1-2 punch that a lot of other companies won't have.
Do you see them kind of doling these shows out in one bucket or the other? Either we're going to put them on CBS All Access, where you pay a subscription fee and there's no ads, or you're going to put them on Pluto TV, where they're ad-supported but it's free, and just kind of dole those out? Or do you think it's going to be a little more compartmentalized than that, and all CBS stuff will live on CBS? Or how do you think they're going to do that?
I think it's going to be a little bit of both. Going back to when I talked to Viacom CEO Bob Bakish, who is now going to be CEO of this combined company, about Pluto, he had stressed that Pluto was always going to have content that was at least 18 months old. So, for example, if it was going to air SpongeBob episodes, it would be episodes from earlier in the run. It wouldn't be anything that had been on Nickelodeon in the last year and a half. And I think that's going to be probably the strategy for any content. They've talked on the earnings, or they talked about the investors call the day this merger was announced, about very quickly taking the CBS content, moving it to Pluto, trying to put some Viacom content all on All Access. So I think it's going to be an experiment, and maybe things will be on Pluto for a little bit of time and then come off and go into All Access, and they'll try and figure out exactly what works. One thing I definitely think that you will see is a big chunk of Nickelodeon content, children's content, go to All Access, because that is, children's programming is kind of a key component of streaming strategy these days. With all these new services coming in, if you're tempted to cancel a streaming service for something else, but it has a show that your kid loves, like let's say SpongeBob, you are not going to be able to cancel it, because your 4-year-old or 5-year-old is not going to allow that to happen. So they see this as like a really big opportunity for them to take a lot of Nickelodeon shows and put them potentially on All Access. And suddenly that catapults that from an outlet that, Good Fight is a great show in Star Trek, but maybe there's not anything else, to an essential component of your kind of media, your media home, your media diet.
I have one really important question on that front. Where is Avatar The Last Airbender going to end up? Because that thing has been like my white whale of trying to hunt that thing down on streaming, and it's just never popped up. Where is it going to go?
That's a good question. And I really think a lot of shows like that haven't been on streaming for a long period of time. SpongeBob is another. If you look at shows like Big Bang Theory, which have never been streaming, all of these respective companies are going to finally start to tap that for their streaming services. So I can't say for sure where that show is going to end up, but I definitely feel like within the next year or two, almost all of the biggest shows that have not been available on streaming are going to be in the streaming ecosystem somewhere. And unfortunately, they will probably all be at different outlets, you know, kind of forcing you to subscribe to a ton of them.
Kumiko, do you have a like childhood comfort show that either has not been on streaming or that would motivate you to be part of a streaming service?
Well, I don't have one that's not on the streaming services. I don't know how long ago Hulu added Golden Girls.
it was about a year ago. Yeah.
But I did notice, you're right, because I did notice when I first started getting like Netflix and things like that, like I was like, where the hell is Golden Girls? Why is it not on here? That is a classic. So ever since that was added, I've kind of been in a good place.
my kids currently, it's We Bear Bears. Like wherever We Bear Bears lives is where my kids insist that we which at the moment I think it's actually split between Netflix and Hulu, like it's on both. But you know, to Jason's point, it has a lot of sway. Like I guarantee if we said, we're going to cut Hulu, my kids would be like, no, that's where the newer We Bear Bears are. Which, by the way, that's a really good show if you've never watched it. It, despite the name sounding very childish, it's real good. Really great writing. Lisa, does your kid have like a must-have show?
He does. I mean, I feel like he splits his time between Prime Video and YouTube. He watches a lot of stuff on YouTube. He likes like that Ryan kid who unboxes toys. I don't know about Hulu, but Netflix. It's superheroes. He's into that. He's found there's Star Wars stuff on Netflix, I believe. So he's pretty evenly spaced out.
All right. Well, let's talk about TCA, the Television Critics Association, where Jason has been, as he mentioned, for the last 3 weeks. This is one of the biggest gatherings, obviously, of television critics, but of TV executives as well. It almost probably rivals the upfronts in terms of getting everybody together in one place. Jason, what was the big topic this year? Like the thing that everybody, whether on stage or just in conversations in the hallway, what was everybody thinking about?
So it's interesting because usually when you go to these events and we've talked about this before, but every day a new media company or network comes and their execs are there, their shows that are going to come out in the next 6 months are there. So it's not only the broadcasters who kind of talk about like the fall shows, but it's cable, it's streaming, it's everybody. And these peak TV, you know, this peak TV era, press tour is getting longer and longer as there's more outlets. And usually, you know, when I do my wrap up at the end of this, it's always like, there's, you know, four or five, you know, big topics that everybody was talking about or kind of, you know, came to the forefront. And this year for the first time, this summer for the first time, there was basically, it boiled down to one thing, which was, in essence, the entire industry versus Netflix. So where in the past, you would have, you know, maybe a broadcaster coming up and talking about, well, we're going to be better than, you know, our broadcast competitors. We're going to, you know, CBS will be better than ABC or NBC this year. This is why. And the cable companies doing the same thing, you know, HBO and Showtime rivaling. This year, basically, everybody has dropped kind of those squabbles. And it's just all about, this is why we're better than Netflix, or this is why we're as good as Netflix. And while some of them didn't say Netflix by name, they just talked about, you know, their rivals, but it was very clear that they were talking about Netflix when they were just talking about companies that have incredible amounts for their programming budget. I mean, everything was clearly pointing the finger at Netflix. Other people called Netflix out by name, but it was really interesting where broadcast, cable, streaming outlets all lined up together, coming up with a bunch of different ways. And I wrote a story that kind of summed up seven ways that they all felt that they were superior to Netflix, which is really just interesting and really speaks to the way that in just 5 years, Netflix has really become kind of the center of the TV ecosystem, and everyone feels like they need to position themselves, you know, versus Netflix and not the other dozens or hundreds of outlets that exist.
I mean, is there blood in the water here? Or do they sense that there actually is a you know, a weakness that they can go after with Netflix?
Well, I think there's two different things. One, there is a little bit of blood in the water because on the last Netflix earnings call, for the first time ever, they lost U.S. subscribers. Now, this was a small amount. And I think that if Stranger Things had come out a week earlier, which would have been in the second quarter, that it probably would have erased, you know, any potential subscriber losses that they had. But still, like, it's this first indication of, wait a minute, okay, this is actually a company that is not necessarily going to just endlessly grow and add subscribers every quarter. So you saw that. You saw, you know, a little bit of vulnerability there. And even going back to, like, the you know, there has been more backlash against Netflix this year from consumers than ever before. You think about the outrage when they canceled One Day at a Time, which, you know, again, wasn't maybe a Stranger Things level hit for them, but had a very vocal fan base. And all of a sudden, it's kind of this, wait a minute, Netflix was always supposed to kind of save my favorite shows. Now they're canceling a show that somebody else needs to save. So you know, you're getting kind of the first inklings that you know, Netflix may be a little bit of a backlash growing. At the same time, you have what I keep referring to as Streamageddon coming up, where you're going to have Disney Plus, you're going to have HBO Max, you're going to have whatever NBC Universal's offering is going to be, you're going to have Apple TV Plus, you're going to have all these new streaming competitors, which are going to be fighting for your time when there is already more TV shows ever, you know, than have ever, you know, been made before. So they are, you know, I think this is going to accelerate cord cutting. So everybody is feeling the pressure to say, this is why we still matter. This is why we're still important. And Netflix is not the be-all end-all of the TV world, as much as they say that they are, and as much as they want to be, they're not. And here are things that we can do that Netflix can't. So it's been really interesting to see, you know, to see kind of everybody kind of align along those lines.
And I'm not going to take us away from TCA, but Lisa, while we have you here, you are Amazon expert. You know, Amazon's been a really interesting player in the streaming space. I mean, I think their original programming has really been, you know, somewhat up and down maybe, but really been stellar in the last year or two. But what outlook do you have from them of how big of a play their streaming, you know, aspects are going to be over this next year as this Streamageddon is coming?
Boy, part of the business that I've followed super closely, I think of like Fleabag, which was wonderful and I loved, and why another reason why it's hard to, like, they get you into the Prime ecosystem and it's hard to get out of that. But in terms of how that figures into their priorities, I'm not 100% sure. They have so many irons in the fire between you know, the cloud business and Go and why ever they're getting people's body scans, that the fashion business seems to be a pretty huge priority. But I did a story a couple of weeks ago about when Nike scans part of your body, it's not quite as scary as when Amazon scans part of your body, because Amazon does so many other things. So yeah. The potential, or the sky's the limit, whereas with Nike, it's probably more going to be limited to shoes and stuff like that. So Jason maybe probably would be better, has a better.
Yeah, the Amazon TV execs were at Press Tour and they reiterated something that they have said before, but they felt was especially important as we're entering kind of this new round of the streaming wars. And that is, unlike every other streaming outlet, you know, which their primary purpose is to get you to subscribe, Amazon's is just kind of like an add-on for Prime customers. Like, basically their idea is, we just want to keep our Prime customers happy. Like, we just like, this is just kind of like an additional thing, and if they, you know, pay that money and get, you know, the 2-day shipping or, you know, now 1-day shipping, and you know, see a show like Fleabag, which is probably the best show that's been released this year, that's great. But you know, so they kind of see their job is to kind of keep Amazon customers happy, which is kind of a strange way to look at TV, but is something that, you know, Netflix just needs you to subscribe. Amazon just hopes that you will keep your Prime subscription. But, you know, but Prime Video is one of dozens of kind of add-ons to that, you know, that those shipping benefits that you get there.
Well, I think you sort of saw that too with the Prime Day concert, where they were pushing the music streaming service so heavily and weaving in all of these other different Amazon products. Because that is sort of they're looking to sign up people, get more people into the Prime universe, and probably offload some stuff that's been sitting in the fulfillment centers for a while. But mostly they just want to sign up more Prime members, and they say that they did. So it's effective.
What's interesting to me is I really do think of Amazon more as my new Redbox, right? Like it's just where I rent movies. Like that's where and buy them. And maybe that's the bigger play, is that a few years ago I think where you bought digital movies was a bit more of a Wild West, right? Like it was, you know, there were so many options of what you could do, and I think sometimes it was still easier just buy a Blu-ray. And then now I just default to buying it all on Amazon, like every time a new movie comes out. And I think that stuff keeps me in the ecosystem. Not that you have to be a Prime member to do that, but I now think of Amazon as like my movie hub with occasional good shows like Good Omens or Fleabag or something. But yeah, it's interesting. I was just curious, because I do feel like they've always had one foot in this argument. But to both of your points, like, they can survive this war with no real problem. But Jason, so tell us, what was some of the other kind of biggest announcements that came out of TCA?
So there weren't too many other ones. I mean, I would say probably the biggest programming announcement, and there's usually a few of those, was FX announced that they finally have figured out what the third season of American Crime Story is going to be, and it's going to be called Impeachment, and it's going to focus on the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky scandal. And what's interesting about this is that Ryan Murphy had toyed with doing this a couple years ago, and he ultimately dropped the idea because he felt like I think he had come across Monica Lewinsky, and he had actually realized, like, I only feel like she needs to be the one who is involved in helping to tell this story, and if she's not involved, I don't want to do it. And she's actually going to be a producer on this now, which is really interesting. And John Landgraf, the chairman of FX Networks, has said that this is going to – it's going to follow that story from the point of view of the women involved. So it's Monica Lewinsky, it's Linda Tripp, it's Paula Jones. And, you know, we get the sense that if Bill Clinton is involved at all, he's going to be kind of a minor point of that story. The American Crime Stories has been kind of one of the most successful things FX has done. Obviously, People versus O.J. Simpson, I think, averaged something like 12 million people, which especially for FX is just, you know, sensational numbers. Then season two, which was about the assassination of Gianni Versace, was not as big of an audience success, but it was also it did really well at the Emmys. And this one, which by the way is going to be released in September 2020, right in the thick of election season, is kind of sure to be very provocative and much discussed.
Yeah, I think I'd be a little more dubious of this one if it hadn't been for the second season of Slow Burn, the Slate podcast. You know, their first season was about the Nixon impeachment and Watergate, and it was fantastic. And then I think some people were kind of skeptical of that when season two was dedicated to Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. But, you know, man, it was fascinating. It was a great podcast. To your point, Monica Lewinsky was not involved. You know, I think they kept trying to get her, and I can't remember whether she ended up agreeing to it. It's just been a while since I listened to it. But it definitely felt like it would have been much better had she been involved. And I think just that story has changed in the cultural lens so much since, you know, some of us lived through that as adults. And the perception of Monica Lewinsky, the perception of each of these players, the perception of Bill Clinton, so different than it would be in kind of a post-Me Too era, in just a modern era. And I'm fascinated to see it because I do think, you know, listening to that podcast, I was just like, man, the world has been kind of thinking about this in such a different way than it does now. And Monica Lewinsky, of course, has become, you know, a very vocal figure in social media. She's very funny and you know, charismatic on there. She's been a big advocate against bullying and has worked with the agency BBDO to put out some really good anti-bullying and kind of online harassment ad campaigns. So yeah, she's kind of emerged in the last few years. I think that'll be a really fascinating project.
Yeah, she had a great interview with John Oliver a couple months ago as well that makes me very excited for this project, especially because she'll be involved in it. And also I really love the casting. So Beanie Feldstein, who's had this great year, she's been in this terrific movie this summer called Booksmart. She was in What We Do in the Shadows. She's appeared in Lady Bird, and she's going to star as Monica Lewinsky in this, and I think it's great casting.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, what else? What else was announced?
As far as programming announcements, that was the big one. But I will say I don't want to talk too much about the broadcast shows I was most interested in, because I have a feeling we'll talk about that as we get closer to the new season. But I will say the one show overall that really kind of seemed to stand out in what was more a mediocre year or mediocre press tour overall as far as new shows go. And that was it was another Amazon show, going back to Amazon, called Modern Love. And it's an anthology series that's based on the New York Times column, which has also become a podcast on its own. And every episode focuses on a different story that appeared in one of the columns. And I haven't really followed Modern Love all that much in the time. So I just kind of expected this was just going to be like a romantic comedy, you know, almost like the ones that Gary Marshall used to direct, like the anthology ones where like everybody would fall in love over a holiday. And it'd be like, oh, it'd be kind of a meet cute type thing. This is very, you know, this was surprisingly moving. And these aren't just kind of traditional kind of romance stories. There's different types of love that are involved. One is between the relationship that a single mom has with her doorman, who becomes kind of like a father figure confidant. Another, Anne Hathaway plays a woman who it kind of starts. It starts as more kind of just like this traditional like romantic comedy, and then you find out kind of a lot of things about her. And then, you know, story ends up being more about her. And they're all very different. And that was, you know, this idea of like a really big swing, something that you just don't see very often on TV. And that is out of every show that I saw, and I saw a lot of shows at Press Tour, that was the one that I was the most kind of optimistic and intrigued about. That one's going to come out in October.
All right. Well, thanks so much for helping recap all that. And definitely recommend everyone check out, if you go to adweek.com, check out our TV video section. You will find no shortage of articles that Jason has been filing from TCA and his team, and some really good takeaways from all this. So definitely check that out. And his coverage of the Viacom-CBS merger. And we'll, like you just said, we'll have you back on, because fall is coming fast. So we've got a lot of TV to talk about. Jason, thanks for joining us this week.
Sure.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, and then we come back. We're going to talk about this year's Project Isaac winners, the big awards that Adweek gives for innovation and invention. So we'll be right back for that. All right. We're back. Both Jason and Kimiko had to step out. So Lisa, thanks for sticking around, so it's not a lonely podcast for me.
Oh, no. I'm happy to keep you company.
My mom says she appreciates it. You know, she can't pick me up for another 45 minutes. So let's talk about Project Isaac. This is an award. I don't actually know how long we've been giving this one out. I want to say it's probably 7 years or so. I should know, but it's named after Isaac Newton. It's awarding invention, innovation, discovery in marketing. So this is one of our more open-ended awards. Like, we really try to. It's not necessarily about results or about even craft necessarily. It's about ideas and pushing the boundaries of what marketing is and can do. So with that, our biggest winner, since it's named after Isaac Newton, is the Gravity Award. The Gravity winner for this year is the Traffic Jam Whopper from We Believers. Lisa wrote the article about this one in this week's print edition, so she's going to tell us a bit about it. But first, let's listen to a little of the case study. This is a campaign out of Mexico to set up the case study a little bit here. Essentially, the Burger King found a way to deliver Whoppers to people stuck in traffic jams, which is something that we've all, I think, experienced sitting in traffic and thinking about food, and they have closed the gap. So let's listen to a little bit of that.
The Traffic Jam Whopper. We used real-time data to detect our potential buyers in a traffic jam to offer them a Whopper and deliver on the moon.
Fernanda, buenos días. Señor Eduardo, buenas tardes.
Ay, qué bello.
Llegaste en chinga, cabrón. Me cagaba de hambre.
our media was 100% dynamic, promoting our service only in high congestion zones. By leveraging traffic and drivers' real-time data, we adjusted our billboards' location and content. The messages displayed information about the remaining time in traffic to order and personalized updates about deliveries in progress. Also, Waze banner ads and push notifications invited drivers to get a Whopper as soon as they entered our delivery zones. People were able to use voice commands to place the order and avoid tickets. Finally, using the latest Google Maps APIs, our app pinpointed vehicle location and speed in order to deliver for the first time ever to a driver on the move.
All right, Lisa, as I mentioned, you wrote the story about this one. Tell us how this idea came about. How were they inspired to do this?
Well, it almost seems like one of those stories that's a little too good to be true. But Mexico City, according to I think it was TomTom, their figures, they say Mexico City has the worst traffic in the world. And so the guys from We Believers were on their way to a meeting with Burger King CMO. Is it Fernando Machado?
Fernando Machado. Mm-hmm.
Machado, yes. So and he had said that. I don't know if he said he wanted something super relevant to Mexico prior to that or whether that was something that he said in the meeting itself. But anyway, it was like an hour-long ride in an Uber on the way to this meeting. And so as they were trying to think of these super relevant ideas for Mexico, Gustavo Loria was like a light bulb and said, hey, traffic is bad. Why don't we deliver Whoppers to people stuck in traffic? And the rest is history.
Yeah, so that's Gustavo Loria, the chief creative officer at We Believers. And yeah, to your point, this is one of those, like, if you made a movie about advertising, right? And like you're on your way to the pitch and you don't have the ideas. It's like an episode of Bewitched or something. And you get struck by like, I'm stuck in traffic, man, if only I had a burger. Wait, guys, that's
yes,
it.
yes. So he said that Machado accepted it right on the spot. There was no formal pitch. I think over the course of our interview, the first time he said it took 3 seconds. The second time it was less than 5 minutes. So, but very short window before he approved it. And then, there were a lot of details to work out. The Burger King Mexico app, I think, was a little bit dated, so they couldn't integrate something like this into that. So they had to make a whole new app, they had to get people to pre-register, and they were very surprised by how many people, I think it was 10% of the people who downloaded the app, were willing to give their email addresses, credit card numbers, their car make, model, color, license plate number. And I guess Burger King Mexico had never done mobile payments before, so they were very optimistic about that. And then this was just a month-long program back in April, I think. So it was sort of like they haven't fully integrated it into the point of sale system, so that's, I think, something that they're thinking about doing now. But they figured out these fixes to kind of make it work for the month, for kind of to test this out. So they had iPads next to the cash registers, so the restaurants kind of, you know, knew what was going on and what orders were coming in. But they had to get the delivery drivers these handsets that were compatible with the GPS system, and then they realized that it would have to be voice activated in order to comply with traffic laws, and they also had to have these voice assistants speak Spanish, which was another challenge. So because people were in their cars and driving, the menu had to be very simple. So there were a lot of technical things to work out, but they made it happen for this month long test.
This is like a classic modern Burger King plan, because they come up with these ideas, or at least Fernando approves these ideas that come out of their many, many different agency partners. The ideas are always these really simple, you know, one sentence idea that makes total sense, that they're completely obvious once you say them out loud. And then they are bafflingly complicated to execute. And to their credit, you know, Burger King puts in the work and these agencies put in the work. You listed not even all of the logistical hurdles they had to get over to make this thing happen. When you talk about the dynamic ads that would promote all this stuff, and the ads even let people know, hey, if you're in this car, like your Whopper is coming. I mean, they really went all out. And to your point, they it was a limited time thing and in a specific area, but that allowed them to kind of go deep on the functionality.
Right. Yeah, no, they had to identify the traffic hotspots and which places had restaurants close enough so they'd be able to do delivery in 30 minutes or less. And I think it was a small number of cases, like 10% of the time, where the driver actually had moved out of the delivery window. So it didn't totally work all the time. But there was also, I think they said 10 to 15% of the time, at the point the delivery driver was leaving the restaurant, the car happened to be like right in front of the Burger King. So they just, you know, were able to just hand it off.
Just lob it through your window.
Yeah.
Whopper Detour from FCB New York, of course, was kind of the biggest talker this year in the sense of it won at Cannes and it won the Titanium Grand Prix at Cannes, which is a similar kind of innovation thing. But here's my thing with Whopper Detour had a few issues to it that I would say differ from this and make this one a really good kind of Project Isaac top winner, is that Whopper Detour is a little confusing. I mean, it's not a little confusing. It's very confusing. It's this idea you get a free, well, you get a 1 cent Whopper. But to get it, you have to download the app, you have to enter all your info, you have to go to a McDonald's, you have to unlock the coupon, then you have to go to a Burger King. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
I get it, and it's super clever. And they admit that, you know, Fernando Machado has said, this is the most backward idea. It violates every rule of marketing. It should have failed miserably, but instead it was one of their most successful campaigns of all time. But you can't scale it either, right? Like, you can't do Whopper Detour 50 times in 50 different places because everyone's going to say, oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that. You know, it got its one huge burst of publicity. It really taught the brand a lot about some of these issues we're talking about how they use their app and how they use mobile ordering and how they use, you know, a lot of these different features. Geofencing, right? That's at play here, too, of kind of drawing these lines of where can people participate in this via mobile. So it covers a lot of those, but this idea is almost infinitely scalable. I mean, not to say that every city has traffic this bad, but a whole lot of cities have traffic this bad.
Yeah, they're talking about bringing it to some other cities, LA, Sao Paulo, Shanghai, and they even mentioned the U.S. border as a potential place to do this because there are lots of people waiting in lines. But the, you know, every country has a different app or not all Burger Kings in other countries have the same app, and these countries have different traffic laws. So there's a lot of things they have to figure out. And plus, I think Burger King Mexico wanted to integrate what they've done into their POS system. It's already system, so I said it twice. Sorry.
I thought POS was point of sale.
Oh, no, point of sale. Maybe not. Sorry. So they had to do some integration work and then kind of figure out how to I guess comply with laws in other countries and things like that. But yeah, it does have potential. They'd also mentioned stadiums that had Burger Kings in them already. So so delivery to your seat was a possibility as well.
Or, you know, when an amphitheater concert, like a Widespread Panic concert or something's getting out and everyone's sitting in that long line of traffic waiting to leave.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there you go.
You know, it's like 2 a.m, bring you a Whopper. Oh,
yeah,
it's a million-dollar idea. Let's cut this out of the podcast. Me and you pitch that part to Fernando.
Perfect.
Well, it was certainly one of the – obviously, it got our Gravity Awards, this one that we really felt – accomplished a lot of things. It required a ton of innovation and a ton of hard work, but the concept is just so simple and so scalable, and that's something we really looked for. Let's talk about a few of the others. I won't linger on this one because we did a whole podcast episode about it, but HBO's Westworld app, The Maze, from 360i is the agency behind that, that used Alexa in some really kind of fascinating ways to create this hours of content through an interactive game with professional voice acting. We did a whole bonus episode on this with the creators from the Cannes Lions. So if you're really into that one, you can definitely go back through the podcast feed and check out our interview with the creators from 360i who made that one. Other than that, I guess, Lisa, I would just throw out, since again, you're our Amazon guru, there aren't many like super ambitious voice things, you know? I remember even talking to them about it when I asked, you know, did you have any other big voice activation in-depth skills you could look to for inspiration? They were like, not really. they're just having, this doesn't seem like a field that marketers have gone all that deep in.
Yeah, I was really excited about voice search a couple of years ago, but I feel like it's, I mean, so going back to maybe 2015, 2016, I feel like everyone was just, or Google and Amazon and the companies making these devices were very, very sensitive about, I mean, they want to drive adoption, so they don't want to bother you. They don't want, you know, they're trying to, I feel like the episode of Seinfeld where Elaine is describing the potential boyfriend as a squirrel she's trying to lure towards her, and she doesn't want to make any big sudden movements. It's like that, you know, they're trying to bring more customers into the fold. And I haven't honestly done much on voice search or voice-enabled devices recently, because I think that that's maybe still the case. I mean, there was that Beauty and the Beast movie announcement that Google says was not an ad. It was just them providing information and no money was exchanged. But people, I feel like, were not super happy about that when they were asking sort of, you know, like, hey, Google, what does my day look like? And Google said, oh, by the way, Beauty and the Beast is in movie theaters. So so I don't know if anyone has figured that out yet. I mean, it obviously will come. I mean, it's people, we pay money for TVs, and we've been seeing ads on TV for a very long time. I'm sure that they'll figure it out eventually, but I don't really know. I can't think off the top of my head of any really great. And now when I say that, I'm going to go back to my desk and then I will see something that I should have mentioned. But it's still the, I don't know, Wild West, uncharted territory, something like that. No one's figured it out yet as far as I know.
Yeah. And, you know, part of it is that these are just very much appliance devices, right? Like, I don't – when I plop down in my living room, I've got – you know, a PlayStation, I've got a Nintendo, I've got the Amazon Fire TV or whatever. Like, I have these things that I think of as my entertainment devices. That's where I go when I want to be entertained. Like, my voice devices are not in those same areas. They're in high traffic, like on the counter in between the kitchen and the whatever. You know what I mean? It's like, it's where you can walk by and just ask it what the weather's going to be. I was thinking about that how many people even have these devices in a place where they're going to sit down and have a 3-hour entertainment experience with a voice activated device beyond your phone, which is different. You know, that's not necessarily this is really more about the homes and the Alexa devices. But yeah, anyway, so I recommend anybody who wants to know more about that one, definitely check out our special episode on that. I wanted to mention Uncle Drew. This is one pretty fascinating piece of branded content that evolved from what started as a digital short with Kyrie Irving, the basketball player, basically dressing up as an old version of himself and kind of embarrassing young guys on the court and being an awesome basketball player. And it was a short that they made with Pepsi. I think the agency is FMCGG, and Pepsi's content studio did a lot of this, but they turned it into an entire Hollywood movie. and it made $44 million. And that's just not something you see too often. When it does, it's usually kind of cringy, right? When a branded character or mascot gets something that big, you're like, ooh, nah, I don't think we need a progressive flow movie, you know. but this one, I think it relies on you really caring about Kyrie Irving, being a basketball fan, you know. But in the end, they turned it into a pretty solid. Well, I'll quote the Lou Arbiter, the general manager for the content studio at Pepsi, said in our piece, he said, no one wants branded content. No one wants branded entertainment. They just want entertainment. And, you know, but if you can sell some Pepsi along the way and make $44 million off your movie, pretty good too. So very impressive, ultra ambitious. I think it'll be fascinating to see what comes of that. Like, who points to Uncle Drew and says, let's do that, you know, with our Super Bowl ad character or whoever. could be good, could be abused. But I think the thing with that one is if you put all that money into building a movie around a character that people don't care that much about, you're going to be the one who pays for it, literally. So be interesting to see what brands do with that. One big winner, Lockheed Martin and McCann are always on this list. Like every year, they're always making a VR astronaut helmet or a bus that drives around Mars. You know, they're like always doing something in this space. This year, it was a recruiting tool they made. Basically a giant mysterious box that they would bring around to different universities, and students who are looking at going into engineering type career paths would go into this box, and they would have to solve really difficult problems. One of them was supposedly almost impossible to solve. And it was described as the first ever animated infinity room, created with angled mirrors and a ceiling mounted digital screen. It's very immersive. There's some great videos of it. You can check it out on our site. I mean, at a time when most companies, if they're there to recruit you, they're just going to bring some, you know, some brochures or whatever. Like, they're not going to bring a gigantic box you walk into. Lockheed just always stepping that up and pops up on this list every single year. One I was really excited to talk about because I love the ones on this list that we've never heard of, that we have not covered. This is great. It's from Argentina. It's from a mobile phone company called Twenty, I think Tuenti. This is from Wonderman Buenos Aires, which is, again, is always on this list. Wonderman in Buenos Aires is just one of the most innovative agencies for sure. They created a mobile game called, and I might be butchering the pronunciation here, but I think it's Pitaya, P-I-T-A-Y-A. And it is about, instead of you rescuing a princess, it is about a princess taking care of herself. And she goes out and you play as the princess fighting. But instead of fighting, I don't know, giant spiky turtles or whatever, she is fighting against street harassment, being stigmatized, social expectations. We've talked about this on the podcast quite a bit, that in South America, women are harassed all around the world, that's for sure. South America has its own kind of specific issues with things like moral harassment and a lot of really kind of ingrained cultural issues. So to see a major brand like this embrace it in a really clever way of creating a mobile game like this that confronts these things. And the numbers are pretty impressive. It was played for 2.1 million minutes, which averages out to more than 6 minutes per user. I mean, I don't play many things on my phone for more than 5 minutes, so that's pretty impressive. Lisa, what did you think of this one?
I think as a single independent woman, I'm always excited to see examples of of us taking care of ourselves, because there hasn't it hasn't always been that way. So I support anything in that vein.
Yeah, it's really interesting to look at how this could be its own podcast, and we're not going to go down this rabbit hole, but the portrayal of women in games. I play a lot of video games. My wife and my kids play a lot of video games. And, the portrayal of women is just advanced in so many ways. But this takes it to a new place. You know, I think it's one thing to take Lara Croft Tomb Raider from being just this kind of weird sex object to being a very tough, powerful woman in the newer games. Like, she's incredibly powerful and smart, and they've really turned it into a very empowering figure, but this, it's not her walking through the streets of a city being harassed, right? Like, that's a much more, not too many women find themselves scaling cliffs in the Himalayas and being attacked by like mythical ogres or this is a much more real way of bringing it to it. So very cool project, and congratulations to them for creating something really interesting. Man, we've got so many more. I don't have time to talk about all of them. We've got Dove created the hashtag Show Us campaign, where they basically 70% of women felt that they are not represented in images and media and advertising, either because of their race or their ability or just the way they look. And so Dove partnered with Getty Images and an advocacy group called Girl Gaze to create Show Us. And they put more than 5,000 photographs of women from 39 different countries, no airbrushing, and they put them onto Getty Images. They've been downloaded by more than 900 companies across 40 countries and used, and I think 7,500 images from this collection have already been used. So yeah, it's I love seeing these. This was promoted at at Cannes this year at the Cannes Lions. They had giant ads about this, basically promoting it to advertising people, which makes sense, right? Like Cannes Lions, it's mostly advertising people. But it was really cool and just seeing the ads and seeing what kind of images and women that they're talking about. It was really effective, and it's good to see that one blowing up. And then last one I wanted to talk about, just because this did win, maybe it won PR at the Cannes Lions, and it won a Grand Prix at the Cannes Lions. But Wendy's and VMLY&R in Kansas City. Wendy's, of course, is known for being pretty snarky and innovative when it comes to social. And this took it to a new place. They invaded Fortnite. Lisa, I think your kid's not quite old enough to be in the Fortnite addiction phase, right?
No, but he does know what it is. So
it's become aware.
It may be coming.
So Fortnite, of course, has been, I think it might be waning a bit right now, but has been the largest game on earth for the last few years. And I'm sure a lot of brands try to figure out, what are we going to do? Are we going to put an ad in it? Are we going to do some kind of like, you can download a custom skin and then pay a bunch of money to have your custom cosmetics, enhancements for characters put on the game. No, Wendy's went in a much cooler direction. There was a big special event going on in Fortnite. And as part of it, there were these fast food restaurants got dropped into, like these kind of generic burger places got dropped into the Fortnite world. And they had freezers in them. And so Wendy's has this whole thing where their brand is largely built around never freezing their meat. It's always fresh. And they've, of course, have made fun of McDonald's and have arguably driven McDonald's to start using a lot more fresh meat. And so they created a character. I think it's the Little Red Riding Hood character. They used that model to create a Wendy character. And then they had her go in. And while Fortnite, of course, everyone's trying to shoot each other, you're trying to survive the longest. And their character just went in and started smashing all of the freezers and just ignoring the other characters. So it's like it just had to look like an insane person. The first few times people saw it just had to be like, wait, what? Why is there someone just smashing, the freezers? And then eventually people have figured out, it's Wendy. And of course, because Twitch streaming is such a huge part of the Fortnite experience, just doing this in the game might not have been noticed by all that many people, because these games aren't played specifically by that many people at once. But streamers got a hold of it, started finding Wendy, started, amplifying it. And then they started doing the same thing. People were like, I'm going to join Wendy in smashing all these freezers, which is not at all the point of the game and will not help you at all. So if you're doing that, you're doing it as a choice. But I mean, just brilliant, really quick. I mean, I don't know if it cost them any money whatsoever, and they won a Grand Prix at the Cannes Lions, and we have awarded them now a Project Isaac Award, just because sometimes innovation doesn't mean building a gigantic contraption, although that can do it too. But just saying like, hey, what if we just go into this game and start smashing freezers? And sometimes that's enough.
You know what that reminds me of? That when KFC followed 11 Herbs and the Spice Girls on Twitter, yeah, right? And then it just like eventually somebody noticed and it became a big thing. That's what it made me think of.
Yeah, and there's always backlash on these with the 11 Herbs and Spices. It's like whenever there's a campaign like this, people start private messaging me their complaints about ad campaigns, which is always a sign that they know they are against the grain, because they know if they tweet like, this is dumb, people will be like, shut up. they always say, well, this isn't a real, there's no idea here. There's no big message here. And I'm like, I get what you're saying, but you're wrong, right? In this case, Wendy's has really aggressively associated itself with fresh beef, and for all the cattiness of their Twitter feed, that's the thing. They ran a whole Super Bowl ad about this, making fun of McDonald's and conveying this whole fresh beef thing. This is a brilliant continuation of that with KFC. 11 Herbs and Spices has been their calling card for however many decades that thing's been around, and it never hurts to remind people, especially when you've got a very crowded space that they're competing in. And I mean, honestly, if you can come up with a great idea and pull it off in one afternoon without barely any corporate approval, man, go do it.
Well, didn't didn't the guy who noticed get like a painting of him and the colonel, something like that? I loved it.
He got a custom painting of him riding on. He's either riding on the colonel's back or the colonel is riding on his back. I can't remember exactly which it was, but yeah, like that guy that was celebrated. And there were all these conspiracy theories that people like messaging me like, but if you look at his LinkedIn, he's connected to someone who works at this one office of Wyden and Kennedy. I'm like, God, it was just a dude who noticed. But anyway, so congratulations to all of our honorees in this year's Project Isaac. Check out our print edition this week or check it out on adweek.com. Lisa's great story on the traffic jam whopper and many, many others. Yeah, it's a lot of fun as always. Lisa, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me and chatting. It was very fast food oriented this week.
Yeah, it really was. Our theme music is by Home. This week's episode was produced by Chris Ahrens with production assistance from Josh Rios and edited by Lane McGibney. If you have not already, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Those reviews mean a lot to us and they help new listeners discover the show. You can drop us a note at podcast@adweek.com. We always love hearing from you. Yeah, thanks for listening. And thanks to each of our guests for joining this week. I'm David Greiner for Adweek. We'll be back next week.
Hey there, are you ready to elevate your personal brand or company? Meet Viral Growth, your one-stop shop for video content and audience building. Imagine growing your brand organically on social media without the hassle of editing videos for hours. With Viral Growth, it's a breeze. They handle the brainstorming, scripting, and editing while you simply just hit record. And don't worry about your niche. They cater to everyone, from business and marketing to health and wellness. Are you ready to make waves in the social media realm? Visit viralgrowth.io and use code ADWEEK, that's ADWEEK, all lowercase, and get 10% off your plan.